The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome to the Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and the world has lost a giant in the world of climate change science and communication. I am speaking about the tragic and untimely passing of Dr. Steven Schneider, known as Steve to his friends and colleagues. Dr. Schneider has been a regular guest on my program over the years. He is one of the boldest, most outspoken, most knowledgeable, funny, endearing personalities on the Green Front lines when it comes to climate change science, and I've decided to devote this entire edition of the Green Front to his memory, to his legacy, and I am very thrilled to have two guests who knew him well, both professionally and personally, to remember him as he deserves to be remembered, and his legacy no doubt will live on because he was such that kind of an influence, that kind of a voice, that kind of courage and conviction. We are going to be speaking first with Benjamin Santer. He is a leading climate researcher at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He has described his colleague as the Carl Sagan of climate science. We'll find out more about what he meant by that. And Santer and Schneider were both among the scientists who served on the IPCC panel. They are the ones that shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore. And in a statement on Monday, the day of Schneider's passing, he called his friend and colleague, a prolific researcher and author, and a wonderful communicator whose contributions to the advancement of climate science will be sorely missed, and how. In our second half, we'll be speaking to another guest over the years on my former program, EcoTalk, Paul Ehrlich, who also was a colleague at Stanford University with Steven Schneider. He's a big giant in the scientific world himself. He'll be remembering his friend and colleague as well. I am pleased to welcome Ben Santer to the show. Thanks so much for being with us at, I'm sure, what must be a difficult time for you personally.
Thank you for inviting me, Betsy.
I was very moved, as were many others, by your eulogy that was on realclimate.org, I believe, is the website, if anybody would like to read it in its entirety. You, I'm sure, are shocked and mourning the loss of your friend and colleague in the climate science world. Tell us what you are thinking about now. What sticks out in your mind as you think about the life and the legacy of Steven Schneider?
Well, the world seems a smaller and lonelier place after Steve's passing. It's remarkable to see and read the outpouring of remembrances and tributes to Steve that have appeared in the last couple of days. It's clear that Steve touched hundreds, thousands of lives through the science that he did, through his teaching and mentoring, through his public speaking on climate change. And when you met him, when you came into contact with Steve Schneider, you never forgot it. He was truly a memorable human being, and the unique thing about him, in my opinion, was this combination of first-class scientist, someone who made significant contributions to our understanding of the nature and causes of climate change and the impacts of climate change, yet combined that scientific research acumen with the ability to talk in plain English about what he did and what it meant and why people should care about it. That combination, being not only a top-notch scientist, one of the best in the world, but also someone capable of talking eloquently about what they do, that's rare. I don't see anyone out there like Steve Schneider.
Yes, and his passing, which came about apparently of a heart attack as he was traveling from yet another scientific conference in Sweden. He was on a flight landing in London when he apparently had a heart attack, fatal heart attack, came at a time when climate science is being debated, or at least legislation is being debated in, you know, the Senate, and also as, you know, many Americans were beginning to question climate science because of the deniers and the doubters having, you know, a large platform and microphone and, you know, cable Fox television networks and elsewhere. I would imagine this would be a time that he definitely would want to be around to not only witness what happens, but to be, you know, the loud and influential voice that he always was on this subject.
That's, well, there are many reasons to mourn Steve's passing and to be sad, and an entire community is sad, a community of climate scientists. His peers and friends at Stanford are sad. Obviously, his family is grieving. The other sad thing is that we would need Steve more than ever at the current time, as you pointed out. Humanity is at a crossroads, really. We've come to the recognition, in large measure through Steve's tireless efforts over the last nearly four decades, we've come to the realization that human activities, our burning of fossil fuels, has changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, and those changes in the atmosphere's chemical composition have changed our climate. And unless we get our act together and figure out what to do about this problem, we will continue to introduce significant changes in our planet's climate. Now more than at any other time, we would have needed Steve and his clear, powerful voice bringing us back to the science all the time, reminding us that this is not a belief system. It's not a question of whether one believes in global warming or global climate change. Science is about facts and testing theories. Steve was always bringing people back to the scientific evidence, and the evidence is compelling. We know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we are largely responsible for the changes that we see in the climate system. And the fact that he's gone and we're missing that unique, rare and powerful voice reminding us of the integrity of the science in the face of systematic attempts to cast doubt on the science and the scientists, he will be sorely missed, and it's difficult to see on the horizon someone of Steve's stature who can step into the breach and really make it clear to everyone, to the public, to the media, to policymakers, the choices we face over the next few decades.
And the Chronicle has an editorial about Steven Schneider, and it says, he told a group of journalists and academics at a Stanford event in May that exaggerating what we don't know to discount what we do know leaves us without a way to come to a consensus about what to do. As a scientist, he said, his job was to present the risks. As citizens, our job is to figure out how to manage the risks. What is your last memory of him? When did you see him last?
I last saw Steve at the end of May. Both of us testified together with Mario Molina and Ralph Cicerone in front of the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. It was the first time I had ever testified in front of Congress or the Senate, and I was a little nervous. Steve sensed that I was apprehensive, and he sort of took me aside before the hearing started and said, don't worry, rookie, you'll do fine. And sitting next to Steve Schneider in that hearing room, it was easy to feel fine. It was easy to feel his strength, his courage, his integrity, and the hearing did turn out fine. Steve was masterful. The way he dealt with questions from members of this congressional committee, the way he responded to inaccuracies in the scientific testimony of the witness from the minority side, masterful. It was just vintage Steve. He had a way of speaking that engaged everyone, like that American Express commercial. When Steve Schneider, you know, speaks, people listen, regardless
right.
of who he was speaking to, members of Congress, the public, the media, and that is my lasting and enduring memory of him from this congressional hearing, how forcefully and how well he presented the science, and how he did it with this disarming sense of humor, too. Steve had this unique ability to connect with people, to find storytelling mechanisms, to find metaphors, analogies, to convey complex scientific ideas in simple terms. And that's my enduring memory of him, this vintage Steve at this congressional hearing.
And he also warned about the climactic consequences of nuclear war. That's something that our listeners, many people may not be as aware of, the role he played in that conversation.
Yes, he did. Steve made significant contributions in many different areas of climate science. That was one of them. You may remember that back in the 70s and 80s, there was considerable debate about the climatic consequences of nuclear war. Some scientists contended, based on experiments performed with rather simple climate models, that nuclear winter would pretty much mean the end of life on planet Earth. Steve and his colleagues then performed experiments where they tried to emulate the effects of massive nuclear exchanges and tried to estimate the effects on Earth's climate of such exchanges. Found that perhaps nuclear autumn was a better way of describing the consequences than nuclear winter. In other words, the consequences were still remarkably serious, but they were perhaps not as dramatic climatically as had first been suggested. I think that this is a remarkable example of how science works. Steve had been unfairly and unjustly accused of being an alarmist by what you might call the forces of unreason. This was a very clear example of Steve being the scientist that he always was. Let's look at the science, let's see what it tells us, and that should be the driver for figuring out what to do about all of this.
And wasn't he a driving force behind the recent effort to sort of challenge the credibility of skeptical scientists by looking at how often they published their research compared to legitimate client scientists who believe it's a real threat and that humans are causing the CO2
yes.
emission problem?
He was involved in a study recently published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that sought to look at the credentials of scientists in different camps on the climate change issue, folks who thought, as I do and as Steve did, that the science is compelling and credible and that we need to do something about it, and folks who have argued that the science is not compelling and is not credible. The scientific credentials of those two camps were evaluated, and the bottom line was that many of the folks who very publicly and repeatedly and very loudly proclaim that everything that climate scientists do is without any scientific basis, is a hoax, is a conspiracy.
Motivated by money, greed.
that the credentials of many of these folks are lacking, are deficient. And in my opinion, this was an important study because journalists, in the name of journalistic balance, when writing about climate change issues, often seek to involve both camps in their story. And this was something that concerned Steve and many of us, that in the name of journalistic balance, many stories about climate change often fail to really look at the science itself. And he felt, as many in our field do, that the important thing is getting the science right, not getting the balance right between Camp A and Camp B.
You know, mainstream media loves to have a debate, right? We want to have a pro and con, even if that doesn't accurately represent the ratio of thought behind it. And hopefully we're beyond that point. But yet I understand he received death threats for his, position that climate change is real and we're causing it. And I believe it because I was on Hannity and Combs three times talking about climate science and defending Al Gore and debating this guy Chris Horner, who you may know has written a couple of books anti-climate change views being espoused. And I got death threats just from being on for a couple of minutes. I can only imagine how he might have been a target. How did he deal with that?
Well, he was a target. Again, as I mentioned initially, Steve was fearless. Steve would not only do cutting-edge research, he would also try and explain what he did, what he had learned, and what it meant, why we should care about it. He was a master at that. But when you put yourself out in the public arena and when you have the audacity to talk to people about why the science matters, why it's important, you often make powerful enemies. One thing that Steve told me early on in my career was, Ben, you can judge the measure of your success by the number and the quality of the enemies you accumulate over time. Mm. And Steve accumulated, a lot of people who did not like his clear, powerful voice. And he did attract threats. There were, I've seen some of the emails that he received. There were, very nasty attempts to intimidate him. He was not intimidated. He had the courage to keep on speaking out and bringing people back to the science all the time and bringing people back to the issue of risk. That if we continue in a business-as-usual way, that entails risks, significant risks, for our climate. Again, he deserves tremendous credit for his bravery, for his courage, and for taking the very difficult path that he did in science. These combined roles of scientist, communicator, it's difficult to see anyone like him at the present time.
He also embodied personal courage with his fight with a very rare and deadly form of cancer. Many people were not aware of that. I was until I fortunately had a chance to have a conversation with him at an event about 6 months ago when I learned not only did he go to the same high school my husband did a few years apart in New York on Long Island, but also that he was battling a disease that he said by all accounts should have killed him years ago, about 8 years prior to that. He really managed his care and really took on his doctors. In fact, he wrote a book about that.
Yes, he did.
The Patient from Hell. Is that the name of that book?
That's the name of the book, and I would recommend it to your listeners. It does exemplify Steve's courage, and it also shows how he didn't accept conventional wisdom. He wanted to fully understand what was happening to him, what this disease was, how to manage it. He participated fully in dealing with this disease. There are many lessons there for all of us. And that book and his courage under this tremendous pressure that he was living is an example to me. It's an example, should be an example to all of us. Again, the thing that was remarkable looking at his illness is that he continued doing his job. He continued fighting for the science he loved, doing the science that he loved, despite these significant physical difficulties.
And if that a lesser man
or a lesser woman would not have been able to continue to work under these circumstances.
Yes, and he drew parallels between battling climate change awareness and trying to awaken the slumbering masses, and also with managing his disease. He said there's no room for error, and there are a lot of unknowns, yet there's enough that is known that we have to take action. He has to take action on the personal medical front, and we have to take action on the global climate front.
That's right. He again, was just wonderful at seeing relationships between things, telling stories, seeing the metaphors. And I think what he was trying to get across was that in our day-to-day lives, all of us have to take decisions not against a backdrop of perfect knowledge about outcomes, be they medical or financial, but against the backdrop of uncertainty. Should we take this treatment? What are the risks? What could go wrong? And that's the climate change issue. We don't have perfect knowledge about the future shape of...
Hello? Have we lost Ben? Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we hope to continue our conversation, which was supposed to last a few more minutes, with Ben Santer, talking about the late, great scientist, author, educator, and just a wonderful man, a human being, Stephen Schneider. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. We'll be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing, talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I was speaking with Ben Santer about Dr. Stephen Schneider's life and legacy when we got cut off. Sorry about that, but we want to continue the conversation for at least a few more minutes before we bring in Paul Ehrlich to do the same, and that is recall the life and times and incredible contributions of Dr. Schneider, climate scientist and professor at Stanford and author and gifted communicator. So, Ben, sorry about that. Just wanted to wrap up with a couple more memories and thoughts about your friend and colleague's legacy.
Well, we're defined as scientists not only by the number and quality of the scientific papers we publish, but also by our humanity, how we interact with others. Steve was a warm, compassionate human being. Again, there's ample evidence of that in the outpouring of tributes and remembrances in the last couple of days. He was a wonderful teacher, a wonderful mentor, and the students he came into contact with will remember him for the rest of their lives and will carry on in Steve's vein. Their lives, their careers will reflect at least a little bit of what they received from Steve. He was also a wonderful friend. He and Terry would frequently have guitar evenings where they would invite musician friends who played the guitar and piano over to their house, and they were wonderful, wonderful times. We would make music, we would have good food, we would have good wine, we would talk about life, the universe, and everything. And I will miss those times. I will miss that privilege of listening to Steve expound on life, the universe, and everything. It's very sad to me to realize, as I did late last night, that I'm never, ever going to receive another email from him. His wonderful emails are gone. That voice will no longer be there at meetings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, public lectures. The only thing I hope is that the lessons that we've learned from him, the importance not only of doing the science but also communicating the science, I hope that we have learned them well, and I hope that many in our community will honor Steve's memory by continuing not only to do the science, but also, as Steve would have liked, to speak out about the work that we do, to make sure that policymakers know about the work that we do, to speak truth to power. We can live our lives in a way that does honor to his memory, and that's what I'm determined to do, and I know a number of my colleagues are too.
To raise our voices, to be continued to be bold and outspoken against the forces of unreason, the voices of unreason, as you said in your beautiful eulogy.
Well, to be fearless, yeah. In science, there was, until Carl Sagan and Steve came on the scene, some reluctance, I think, among many scientists to engage about the work that we do, to engage with the broader public and with the media. To explain in plain English, devoid of jargon, what we do and why they should care about it. some of that reluctance, I think, has been diminished, and it needs to be diminished. That was one of the legacies of Steve and of Carl Sagan. These issues, climate change, you know, the climatic effects of nuclear exchanges, those sorts of issues are too important to leave to one group of people alone. We all have a stake in what happens to the climate of this planet. All of us have some say in what to do about the problem of human-induced climate change. And in order to take smart decisions on the what to do about it, we need an informed, scientifically savvy electorate. That's what Steve tried to do, to turn the public into climate scientists, to give them some appreciation of and understanding of the science.
And with the recent, you know, climate gate, all that, that has now been, you know, shown to be, you know, that there was no attempt and no, you know, actual effort to distort science with what happened at Anglin. How was he feeling about all that as the public opinion began to erode a bit and as more people began to question the accuracy of climate science? Was he getting discouraged as climate science legislation was stalled, as it has been for a year, you know, between what the House passed a year ago June and the Senate is hopefully about to take action on in the coming days and weeks? Was he, would you say, optimistic, pessimistic, and about what was being, you know, debated as legislation got more and more diluted and the debate over cap and trade continued to languish?
I think that ClimateGate was frustrating for many of us. It was, as you mentioned, a manufactured scandal. Four or five investigations, both here at Penn State University and at the University of East Anglia, have exonerated the scientists involved, have said there is no evidence whatsoever that the scientists involved with these 1,000-plus stolen emails were guilty of any wrongdoing. There's no evidence that they behaved outside of the norms of science. And indeed, there's a lot of evidence that scientists involved in these emails were working under tremendous unrelenting pressure from these forces of unreason, pressure that made it very difficult for them to do their jobs. Steve was very concerned about that, and over the last 8-9 months, he has worked tirelessly to set the scientific record straight. I know that for a fact. I've seen and been party to many of the emails he's written trying to set the record straight, trying to defend both the science and to defend his peers who had been unjustly accused of serious professional misconduct. I think it was a frustrating time for Steve and for many of us. I think, again, that his energy, despite illness, in doing everything that he could to set the record straight is truly remarkable.
Okay, then, Ben, I really appreciate your time and your comments. Paul Ehrlich is on another line. He's going to come on with me in just a moment after the break. He wants to say hello to you, I'm sure, and maybe spend a minute recalling your mutual colleague and friend, Steve Schneider. I thank you so much for your eulogy.
Thank you.
Which we'll post a link to on our website, and we'll also give information for anyone who wants to know about the memorial service, which is still being planned for Dr. Steven Schneider, who leaves just a gaping hole, a gap, not only in the world of climate science and climate communication, but just in the world of mensches, if I can say that. He certainly embodied that word, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And just finally, I haven't met many people in my life to whom one could truly use the term great to describe them. Steve Schneider was a great man. He was one of the few people I've been privileged to meet who truly deserved that word great in front of their name.
Absolutely. And whether he was in front of a crowd of hundreds of people speaking or one-on-one, as I had a chance to chat with him at a cocktail party after his speech, and he's the same person, you know. There's no pretense, absolutely no pretense. A man who really embodies integrity and heart and soul, and he will be greatly missed, as we have been saying. Thanks so much, Ben Santer.
Thank you, Betsy.
We've been speaking with Dr. Benjamin Santer. He is an atmospheric scientist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory right here in the Great Bay Area. And next, we'll be speaking with Paul Ehrlich, who's also from the other side of the bay, another Stanford University scientist and professor. He'll be also remembering Steven Schneider right after these messages.